telephone town hall, clean energy quarter, joined by energy economist Bruce Phillips and also John Herter, who involves commercialization of clean energy technology. If you'd like to ask a question,
let's be a touch pass. We have our first call. Question. Let's hear the show. Are you there?
I am there. Thank you for taking my question. So I appreciate looking at my climate change. It's important to me. So I've got to ask, why are we cutting down natural habitat and this energy, this clean energy, out of state? Thanks for the question.
Go ahead. Yeah.
Okay, simply the purpose of this transmission project, the NECEC transmission project, is to import Canadian hydro into the New England power grid to help New England region decarbonize the electric sector. In practical terms, it's going to bring in hydropower, which is very low carbon electricity. As that comes into the New England power grid, it will replace electricity that is currently produced by power plants that are powered with fossil fuels, which are primarily natural gas, which still supplies between 40% and 50% of the megawatt hours in the New England region. And this power is going to be coming into the New England region and delivered into the New England grid right around Lewiston. And as it does that, it's going to displace gas-fired power production across the entire New England region, but also here in Maine. And by displacing the gas-fired generation, it's going to reduce carbon emissions and help the region and the state of Maine achieve the decarbonization goals.
If I could just add to that, Bruce, I think it's a great question. I've been involved in some work with an organization called the Clean Air Task Force out of Boston and the World Resources Institute out of Washington, D.C., looking at the land requirements to effectively decarbonize the electric power sector by building out a lot of solar and wind in Northeast states that are passing legislation to basically be 100% clean energy or renewables by 2050 or 2040. So there's a lot of pending legislation that either is binding or has these targets. And so we've been looking at what's the land use requirements. And actually, when you look at the Northeast Corridor, this is actually a very material concern, because if you want to displace a lot of the sort of all fossil generation with wind and solar, it's actually a non-trivial amount of land. It's quite substantial. And when you consider all of the places that are already built out, and then you, so those are sort of out of the running, and then you actually recognize all of the public land, public forests, state parks, and then all of the land that's already sort of spoken for because it's got a development easement, there's really not a lot left. And if you were to talk to wind and solar developers, they'll tell you that, because there really aren't too many sort of obvious places to build these projects. And so when we're talking about habitat, when we're talking about land use and building these large renewables projects, we really need to understand that, you know, there are some material consequences here. And as somebody my father spent two decades developing wind projects in the state of Maine, I spent a few years developing solar projects. There really is a trade-off that we really need to think about. And when I think about the NECEC project, to me, as a Mainer, I see it in a way where, you know, that's habitat saved in a way where we actually are importing energy from outside Maine, and we don't necessarily, sort of obviates the need to sort of develop maybe as much solar wind as we otherwise would need to in order to decarbonize. Mm-hmm. So,
yep. And so diminishing that footprint that the solar project or wind project would have.
I think a lot of, and just to sort of wrap that up, a lot of the work that we're doing is educating lawmakers about this challenge, this land use challenge, and really getting them to understand how much land it would otherwise take. And so, and to really transition from sort of solar and wind and storage to a much wider suite of zero carbon resources.
Yeah. Thank you both. I want to go now to the first poll question that we're going to be asking. So we're going to want to get some feedback from our audience, as you're hearing from our two experts about the need to greenlight projects like the Clean Energy Corridor. If we're going to meet our climate goals by, as John was saying, by mid-century. With that in mind, would you be willing to publicly support the Clean Energy Corridor? So press 1 if you would be willing to publicly support the Clean Energy Corridor. Press 2 if you would not be willing to publicly support the Clean Energy Corridor. Again, we're asking the audience, would you be willing to publicly support the Clean Energy Corridor? 1 for yes, 2 for no. Okay, a reminder, I'm Ben Dudley from Mainers for Clean Energy Jobs. We're hosting a telephone town hall to discuss the Clean Energy Corridor. I'm joined by Bruce Phillips, an energy economist, and by John Herter, who does work with clean energy technologies. If you'd like to get in the queue to ask a question, please dial *3 on your touchpad. We have our second question now. Paul from Bridgeton. Paul, are you there?
Hi, how are you?
Great, Paul. Welcome.
You mentioned during the last question, you mentioned gas and oil fired power plants. I guess my question is, from what I understand, much of the energy that we use comes from gas and oil. And I'm curious, what percentage of our energy comes from gas and oil? And you know, here's the question I have: is that how much of that is going to be, if this power line is built, how much of that won't we need? You know, what percentage of that gas and oil is this hydro line going to take away?
Bruce,
so yeah, so happy to answer that, and it's obviously important because it goes to just how large a challenge this is. So you know, historically, you know, if we think back over most of our lives, we've had a lot of the New England grid, the energy supplied in the New England grid has come from a mix of fossil fuels that includes coal and natural gas and oil. And what's happened in recent years, to our great benefit, is that the coal portion of that has been largely reduced. There are still two or three very small coal plants in the New England region, but the percentage that comes from coal is today quite small. And there is a certain amount that's produced by oil, petroleum products as well, but that's a very small percentage. Our biggest challenge is the portion of our energy supply that comes from natural gas, which today still stands between 40 and 50% of the megawatt hours in the region. And so, and that's, you know, that's not just Maine, it's the entire region, but it includes generation from natural gas in Maine, where roughly, I think, about half the generating capacity is natural gas fired. So it's a big nut to crack. And fortunately, the New England Clean Energy Connect project is also quite a large project in its own right. It will import roughly 10 terawatt hours into the New England grid each year, you know, once it goes operational. And so that's equivalent to between 15 and 20% of the natural gas generation in the region as it stands today. So this one project by itself, the New England Clean Energy Connect, can reduce the carbon emissions across New England by, say, 15%.
Yeah, go ahead.
You know, and I would just follow up and say that, you know, natural gas is used in a lot of places to backfill when the wind stops blowing and the sun stops shining. And so really, I mean, the remit of the people who operate the grid is to ensure a dependable power supply. And so if you're looking at what's unique about hydro is that it has the exact same operating characteristics or very similar operating characteristics as to natural gas, where it's basically flexible, so it can ramp up and down as more and wind come on and off the grid, and then it's dispatchable. So you can call it when you need it, and if you schedule so much energy to come at a certain day at a certain time, you can get that. So those are two really key sort of characteristics of this particular type of resource that is going to be very important as we continue to build out more wind and more solar, more sort of intermittent generation in New England.
So it's a source of electricity that actually makes solar and wind more viable as long-term solutions for our energy needs. That's a really important point. Reminder, this is Ben Dudley from Maynards for Clean Energy Jobs. We're hosting a telephone town hall to discuss the clean energy corridor. If you'd like to ask a question, please dial *3 on your touchpad. I'm joined by Bruce Phillips, an energy economist, and John Herter, who works in the development of clean technologies. Number three question we have on the line, Elise from Westbrook. Elise.
Hi, can you hear me?
Are you there? Yes, welcome.
Hello. Awesome. So I guess my question is just how much solar power do you think we would be talking about if we wanted to go with an option other than the NECEC?
Well, so I'd be happy to take a crack at that. I ended up a couple weeks ago, for my own education, I actually did a calculation that looked at the amount of water that is stored in the dams that are owned by Hydro-Quebec that did not necessarily go through a turbine but went straight to the ocean. And I looked at the last few years, and I'll sort of spare you the technical jargon, but it was basically the amount, it was 10.4 terawatt hours of energy. And so I looked at, okay, well, if I wanted to build enough solar, how much solar would that be, and what would the land footprint be in order to generate that same amount of energy? And so it turns out that the solar resource in Maine, I mean, Maine is wonderful and beautiful for so many reasons, but the solar intensity is not as good as it is in other parts of the country. It's actually a relatively poor resource in comparison. And so we actually need to build out quite a lot of solar. And so through my calculations, and it kind of depends on sort of what assumptions you're making, but ballpark figure is somewhere in the ballpark of 82 to 90 square miles, really, and which is huge. Nothing but solar panels. And so then I went on Wikipedia, and I was like, well, how big is Portland? And it turns out Portland, I think, is like 69 or 67 square miles. If you add Portland and South Portland together, and if you just coated both cities with solar, you would, at the end of the year, will have generated the equivalent amount of energy that was basically spilled into the ocean from the dams in Canada. And what's interesting about that is that, that solar, if you were to ever build it, you would only get it when the sun's shining. So you would actually get way too much certain parts of the year and certain parts of the day, and nothing, obviously, during the nights a lot of times during the winters.
Total capacity for the year. It's not necessarily when you need it.
Exactly.
Yeah, that's fascinating. A reminder, this is Ben Dudley from Maynards for Clean Energy Jobs, hosting a telephone town hall to discuss the clean energy corridor. I'm here with John Herter, who is involved in the commercialization of clean energy technologies, and Bruce Phillips, who's an energy economist. If you'd like to ask a question, please dial *3 on your keypad. We have another question, John from Dover Foxcroft. John, are you there?
I'm here. Mr. Dudley, Mr. Phillips, Mr. Herter, I appreciate you taking my call this evening. Thank you. I can't seem to understand a position. I'm a Natural Resource Council of Maine member and donor. And as I read through some of their materials, I guess I just don't understand their position that this New England Clean Energy Connect, they say it doesn't actually bring additional energy onto the grid. And can you explain that piece of this to me? Because I'm missing something here with that.
Okay, I'll take a stab at that one. And I'm sorry, but I'm not going to be able to sort of answer what NRCM's thinking is behind that, because I think you'd have to get them to describe what their thinking is. But what I can tell you is my understanding of that issue, and because it's an important one, and it's been front and center on this whole debate over the power contract from Hydro-Quebec and the transmission line coming into Maine, to the point where that specific issue has been litigated both in Massachusetts and before the Public Utilities Commission in here in Maine, where both sides with differing opinions on that issue have had their consultants engage in modeling exercises that have been filed in testimony in both states, and the question's been litigated before the relevant agencies in both states, and both the Public Utilities Commission here in Maine and the appropriate agency in Massachusetts have concluded that the megawatt hours that would come would in fact be incremental megawatt hours, that it is additional, and that it would displace natural gas generation in the region, and therefore it would reduce carbon emissions. So, we have that litigation record that both states have settled on that counters the NRCM position that as you stated it. And I'll just say that, Hydro-Québec itself has said that it now has the reservoir capacity to serve the power contract up in the existing reservoirs in Canada with, once one final increment of capacity is built out in the next 2 or 3 years, what is lacking is the transmission capacity. So that's the last part of the system. But once the transmission link, the NECC project, is built, then the power would come into the region and it would be additional. So you'd have to go back to NRCM on the rest of that, I
think. Excellent. Thank you, Bruce. We're going to go to our second poll now. Please respond using the dial pad on your phone. The question is, would you be interested in speaking with a project team member to learn about options to support the Clean Energy Connect in Maine? Dial 1 for yes, I would like to speak with a project team member to learn how I can support the clean energy in Maine. 2, for no, I would not like to speak with a project team member to learn how I can support clean energy in Maine. Again, answering using the dial pad on your phone, would you be interested in speaking with a project team member to learn about options to support clean energy in Maine? Dial 1 for yes, 2 for no. Okay, and also a reminder, dial star 3 if you'd like to ask a question. And do we have our next question? Yes. Jerry from Freeport. Jerry, are you there?
Yes, I'm here. Thanks for taking my question. So I've heard that some say decarbonization is straightforward and relatively easy. Can you share your thoughts?
You want me to take a crack at that?
Yeah.
You can.
If it was only so easy.
John's got to think about it for a minute.
Yeah, why don't you take it?
So I'd say it's most certainly not easy and straightforward. I will say it's a solvable problem. It's something that we can do, but we need a good strategy for it. The reason is there's three reasons why it's hard. One is the scale of the zero carbon generation that we need to build out to do this. We need to not only get rid of the 40-50% of the existing grid that's served by carbon-emitting natural gas generation, but we also need to decarbonize other sectors of the economy, the transportation and industrial sectors, space heating sectors, and that's going to require electrifying a number of those other sectors or large portions of them. So all told, we need to double the size of the electric grid over the next 30 years, which is the second reason why it's hard, is that 30 years is just a blink of an eye, in terms of the speed with which the electric sector is able to respond to challenges like this. And the third reason why it's hard is, I think, what John mentioned earlier, which is that all kinds of generating resources have their own impacts. And some of them, like the fossil sources, emit carbon, and that's what we're looking to eliminate. But other generating resources have other impacts, whether they're land use impacts or water consumption, impacts on marine ecosystems. And so there's inevitably trade-offs with those. And so between the scale of the build-out that we need to do, the limited 30-year period we have to do it, and the trade-offs we have between competing resources makes this a difficult challenge. That doesn't mean we can't be done. It just means that, we need to grapple with the realities of the trade-offs and make, have a well-thought-out strategy for how to get to the goal we all want to get to.
Yeah, and I would just add that
you know, there are different parts of the world that have different advantages in decarbonization, where you've got the Southwest, Arizona, New Mexico, Southern California, places that are blessed with a great solar resource. You know, they're going to have a different path towards decarbonization than some of the more northern climate countries in places like Maine. And so you really have to deal with what, you know, what type of, let's say, solar and wind resource do you have, and then what else can happen. And so I think a lot of work can and should be done in energy conservation. I happen to be working on a lot of projects that are looking at hydrogen and using hydrogen as an energy carrier, and how can we retrofit natural gas plants? Can we retrofit natural gas plants in order to burn, whether it's hydrogen, a mix of hydrogen and natural gas, or maybe another zero carbon fuel like ammonia? And there are a lot of different sort of pathways that are being pursued right now, because we're going to need a lot of different pathways in order to decarbonize, depending on sort of where we are in the world and what kind of natural wind and solar resources we have. And I would just say that my work in sea level rise, I started modeling sea level rise about 15 years ago, and what I've noticed is that we are chronically underestimating the problem. And really, you know, every year we're sort of projecting what it will be like in 5 and 10 years. And as time passes, what we're finding is that we're actually grossly underestimating sort of the level of progress that we're making and sort of where we're at. And so I would say that, like Bruce said, to do this in 30 years is a true Herculean task, but it is possible, and there are a lot of resources that exist and that are in sort of advanced stages of development and more that are earlier stages of development. But I mean, we really need to be spending $1.6 to $3.8 trillion per year for the next 30 years on climate, and we're only right now we're spending about, well, $350 to $500 billion.
Yeah.
So just a third of the minimum amount necessary to get there. And so there are changes that need to be made, and I would just say that for a place like Maine and for what we have, as a very staunch environmentalist and somebody who is self-described as a aggressive climate hawk, I see this particular project as sort of indispensable to getting us there, and really an opportunity that is shovel ready. I mean, we don't necessarily have all the things that we need to do aren't this sort of far along, and
yeah.
So this is actually kind of a minimum effort to really get us through the next checkpoint,
yeah.
Where we have to do a lot more.
A good first step while we put others in the queue.
Exactly.
Yeah.
So,
again, *3 if you'd like to get in the queue to ask a question. We have a question now. Kathy from Falmouth, thank you for waiting, Kathy. What's your question?
Hi, can you hear me?
Yes.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call. So I'm a big clean energy fan. And I'm wondering, can't we solve this problem with like a combination of wind, solar, and battery storage, and not do this transmission line? Couldn't we use those technologies?
Great question. Excellent question, Bruce.
Yeah. So, wind and solar and batteries, I think, are become a foundation for decarbonization. You know, the cost reductions we've seen in wind and solar technologies, both onshore wind and offshore wind, have been dramatic in recent years, and we're continuing to make significant advances in them, as well as battery systems. And so, I think that most all of us, energy nerd analysts, see wind and solar batteries as being sort of a primary foundational element of the decarbonization thing. That does not necessarily mean, though, that they can get us 100% decarbonization, which is the goal. you know, to say that there'll be a very large component of it, maybe even a large majority, doesn't mean that they can supply 100% of the energy. And the primary problem here is that wind and solar are, of course, intermittent. They only produce when the wind's blowing and the sun's shining. And battery systems, as valuable as they are only designed to store energy for 4 to 6, maybe 8 hours. And so they're good at storing energy produced during the daytime, you know, well into the night. But we have a second kind of a problem that we need to overcome, which is a seasonal and long-duration problem, because we have seasonal differences in when the wind blows and the sun shines, and we have also long-duration wind droughts and long-duration periods of calm. And so we need other kinds of technologies that can fill that long-duration gap that go beyond wind and solar and batteries. And I think, as John was suggesting before, hydro actually has strong complementary capability in that regard, because we can dispatch it up and down typically to balance out the needs and to serve load when the wind's not blowing and the sun's not shining. So batteries and solar is a big part of it, but, you know, we need some complementary technologies, and reservoir hydro is a great candidate for that in this region.
So if today we had enough wind and solar to supply the grid, there'd be seasonal gaps, and if we had that magically right today, all that capacity, wind and solar, filling that capacity, that seasonal capacity gap, would be natural gas and nuclear energy, presumably.
So that's exactly right, Ben. You know, so because all of us ratepayers and electric customers like to have the lights turn on when we flip the switch. And that's really a priority for most all customers, electric customers everywhere in every market that I've ever experienced in my career. And so to keep the lights on, we need something that can supply the energy. And today that is essentially in this region natural gas. And that's what we're talking about displacing with the Canadian hydro.
Great. Thank you, Bruce. Next caller we'll take is Lynn in Portland with a question about the New England energy grid. Lynn, are you there?
Yes. I understand that Massachusetts is paying for this project, and you've been talking about the energy going into the regional New England grid, but opponents of the project are strongly asserting that the transmission corridor is taking energy directly to Massachusetts. So what is the truth there?
So Massachusetts ratepayers, of which I'm one, in fact, you're right, are the ones that are paying for the billion-dollar cost of the project. And so Massachusetts is paying for the cost. The power is delivered into the New England grid in Lewiston, and from there it follows the laws of physics, which means it effectively gets dispersed around the entire regional grid. And that creates several kinds of benefits that are located in different parts of the region, including in Maine. It displaces natural gas in Maine and in the rest of the region, which reduces the carbon emissions, and it also lowers the wholesale price for electricity, which is a major component of customers' bills. And so customers in Maine are expected to see their electric rates go down because of this project, both because of this price suppression effect and also because it's customers in Massachusetts that are paying for the cost of the transmission project.
Excellent question, Lynn. There's a lot of confusion around that. Anything you wanted to add to that, John?
No. Sometimes the way I think about the electric power grid and when I'm explaining it to somebody is that I use the analogy of a swimming pool. And so if the transmission system in New England was a swimming pool and the water in the pool was electricity, you basically have several power plants who are adding water to the pool. At the same time, you have several sort of, you know, whether it's states, cities, or towns with straws that are taking, that are consuming that electricity and taking it out. Mm-hmm. And there's got to be a kind of a nice balance that's struck. So you want the level of the pool kind of in generally the same place. But really, in this example, I would say
it kind of doesn't really matter all that much where the straws are in relation to where the power plants or where the hose is putting the water in. So even though the power is actually coming into Maine, mm-hmm. And it's coming onto the grid through Maine, you could it's in the pool at that point.
That's right.
So somebody in Connecticut or somebody in New Hampshire could you know flip on a light and they're getting the collective electrons from the New England grid. So anyway, that's maybe a way to think about it.
Yeah, great. Thank you. Next question is Rick in Portland. Oh. The question about the source of the clean energy. Rick, are you there?
Yes, it just occurs to me, I hope those straws that are being used are recyclable.
Yeah, exactly.
Right. By the way, I have actually used a straw when I was in Spain about 70 years ago. That's how straws came to be known as straw. Okay, but you don't see those anymore. Anyway, I want to ask about the source. I've heard some disgruntled talk from the First Nations Canada. We're getting a raw deal from the Trudeau government in the way he's trying to complete this trans-Canadian pipeline. And but I'm not. My understanding of this is very incomplete. You know, where is this? Where are these new reservoirs that you spoke of being developed or being expanded? And is it creating unhappiness among First Nations Canada? Can you speak to that?
We might be able to speak to pieces of it. I don't know if you can. Either of you can speak to the without getting to maybe the First Nations piece, which you might not know so well, but the infrastructure that's been built to serve this need.
There's a little bit I could contribute to the answer, but probably not all of it, including the First Nations piece of it, which I'm just not familiar with. But the hydro energy that would be imported into New England would come out of the Hydro-Québec system, so which is an extensive network of reservoir dams that stretch broadly across northern Quebec. So this is not analogous to a situation where somebody's building, you know, one power plant or one turbine, and it's the only power coming is from that one facility. So they have a network of hydro reservoirs in northern Quebec, and their obligations under this contract would be served on a network basis out of that series of complexes. And all of that would be required to serve this contract are, as I understand it, fully operational today, with the exception of one last increment that's going to be completed in the next two or three years. So in terms of the impact associated with this power sale, whatever land use impacts or indigenous impacts there might be, I would expect would be largely already in effect at this point.
No new construction.
Yeah,
and I will say this because opposition groups have lately been talking a lot more about impacts on First Nations, and they speak of the First Nations in Quebec as one group of people, which is sort of revealing of how sort of surface level the argument is. I mean, the First Nations groups in Quebec, actually dozens of them, and they're not a monolith, and they have differing perspectives because they're different people. Take that with a grain of salt and do your own homework on that, I would say. And maybe it's a good topic for a future telephone town hall for us to do. The next question is from Nancy in Blue Hill. Nancy, are you there?
It's East Blue Hill, please.
I know the difference. I was married in East Blue Hill, as a matter of fact.
You were? Oh, good for you.
Yes. It sure is.
Yes.
So, okay. What's your question, Nancy? Happy to have you.
Well, my question is, We can do all these wonderful little things that matter, and we should do them. I'm in my 90s, and I've seen the world change for many, many years. Since I was 50, I've noticed the change. However, the little things like straws and don't use plastic bags and all of us should do that. But the big issue is oil. Oil is what's making the carbon the worst, and our entire atmosphere is going to kill our great-great-grandchildren. So my feeling is anybody really from state to state doing anything about that? Because our president wants to put a big oil pipeline all the way from California to New Jersey. So I don't know how you deal with that. We need to, in my opinion, we need to deal with that because that's the biggest issue of all.
Yes, and actually, we agree with you, and we think this project is particularly on point. John, do you want to take it away?
Yeah, well, I completely agree with you. And actually, what's so wild is if you look at the source of energy sort of generation, that's transportation, that's fuels, that's electricity over the last 20 years. And with all this sort of cost reduction in wind and solar, batteries weren't even around hardly 10 years ago when I actually got into battery into the storage industry. Basically, the amount of oil that's been consumed has flatlined. It has not gone down. And so you're right that we have to attend to that. And that is going to be a pretty extremely, that's going to be a battle. And I would say to the extent that we can, make these small victories, whether we're building solar on our homes, whether we're buying EVs, all that does add up, and there will be some inflection points, certainly, whether it's from a push perspective or a pull perspective, because, the climate has just gone, it's so unrecognizable from what it was when we grew up. But I completely agree that we're going to have to attend to that, and
the analogy I would just add to what John is saying is we need to continue everything we can to develop zero carbon technologies and to deploy them as fast as we can, whether they're new zero carbon technologies like solar and wind or existing ones like reservoir hydro, because we left the Stone Age, way back when, but we didn't leave the Stone Age because we ran out of stones. We left the Stone Age because we invented a better widget. And so we need to work on inventing and deploying these other widgets so we can back out the oil.
Thanks for your question, Nancy. A reminder for anybody who's just joined, my name is Ben Dudley. I'm from Mainers for Clean Energy Jobs. We're hosting a telephone town hall tonight to discuss the Clean Energy Corridor. Joining me are Bruce Phillips, an energy economist, and John Herder, who's involved with the commercialization of clean energy technologies. If you'd like to ask a question, please dial *3 on your touchpad. The next question we have is from Margaret in Gorham.
Hello, thank you for taking my question. I have three concerns. One is, will this assist in eliminating a carbon tax, which our legislators are speaking of currently? Secondly, I have stayed in Quebec with my students and near the hydro lines, and there was a loud ringing consistently, and I was wondering if that was going to be an issue here through the corridor. And also, will this bypass the nuclear grid in Seabrook, or will it tie into nuclear power once it hits back into Massachusetts?
Hey, three-part questions. Carbon tax, noise disturbances from the transmission lines, and bypassing nuclear power. Who wants to take a swing at these?
I used to lobby for the Citizens Climate Lobby, which is a national group, and there are chapters. There are multiple chapters in Maine, and I was volunteered with the Portland chapter, and they are trying to they're proposing legislation, which is a carbon tax and dividend approach, and I think it's a phenomenal idea. It's an idea that has gotten bipartisan support, and I don't really. I mean, I think that is essential legislation to pass, and I don't necessarily see
the NECEC Reservoir Hydro Project affecting that at all. I mean, if anything, I mean, really, the carbon tax and dividend scheme is that you put a tax on carbon, and that you basically take the proceeds and you give it back to everybody. And so, if anything, I suppose it would lower the dividends that everyone's getting, but that's a good thing.
It's to incentivize the creation of carbon.
Yeah. So anyway, that would be my answer for the carbon tax portion of the question.
The technologies are ringing or sound disturbances coming from transmission lines. Is this something that either of you are familiar with?
I'm not familiar with that myself.
It's not something I can speak to.
I'm not sure I can either. I mean, I know. Yeah.
Might be a question for the hydro.
I lived close to a main line in West Alma for a while, but maybe not close enough.
Right. Okay.
To a 345 line, I think.
Okay. We'll look into that, Nancy. Not Nancy, Margaret, I think that was. And then the last part of your question is the connection to nuclear power. There are two nuclear stations still in New England. How does this relate to those?
Yeah, this will complement, so nuclear is actually our largest single source of zero carbon generation in this region today. And, what we found when we retired nuclear plants, such as Vermont Yankee and Pilgrim, the Pilgrim nuclear plant in Massachusetts, is that zero carbon energy gets largely replaced by natural gas generation, which increases carbon emissions. And that's a serious dilemma, because our nuclear plants are aging in this region, and there's a lot of debate over how long they should continue to operate and whether they should be retired on their current license schedules, or whether those license schedules might be extended at some point. And so, I don't think the impact of the NECEC project and the importation of the Canadian Hydro with that in the first few years of the project is going to have an impact on the nuclear operations. But longer term, the fate of those nuclear plants are important. Because if we retire them, that means that we need that much more other zero carbon energy from some source, which could be any one of a number of sources.
My friend Dick Anderson likes to point out that the amount of energy proposed to be supplied by the Clean Energy Connect is the equivalent of two nuclear power plants the size of Main Yankee. So it's non-nuclear, carbon-free, or low-carbon electricity generation.
I would just say that, a nuclear plant, I mean, regardless of what you think of nuclear, a nuclear plant hasn't really been constructed and completed in the United States, I believe, since the mid-90s. It's been about 40 years. And if you look, I was looking at the amount of zero carbon energy that was produced in the United States last year. And actually, the combination of solar and wind, we've been building more solar and wind than any other generation source for the last couple years. And if you, and even with that, nuclear still represents over 60% of the zero carbon electrons on the grid.
Yeah.
And if you look on an energy basis, unfortunately, solar and wind is still, I think it was either 6 or 8% of the energy generation nationally, even though we're building more of that than anything else right now.
Yeah.
And so those old new plants, regardless of how you feel, is really they're kind of getting us at least moving forward to build some more zero carbon options. So anyway,
our next question is from Tony in Winslow. Tony, are you there? Tony? Oh, we lost Tony. How about Paul in Dedham?
Yes, I'm here.
Hey, Paul. Welcome.
Hey.
What's your question?
The power come from Canada, coming to Lewiston and going down to Massachusetts. Maine is prob- probably not going to receive any of that power to use, and it probably won't lower the rates at all to the general public for the customers. That's what I'd like to know.
Yeah, good question, Paul. I think you're speaking for a lot of people who want to know the answer to those questions.
Right, and like a couple of the other earlier questions, that your question's been on many, many people's minds to the point where it's been litigated in some of the proceedings in Massachusetts and in, here in Maine, where people have wondered about whether this Canadian hydro will have an impact on electric rates in Maine, and I believe that the findings of the Public Utilities Commission when they investigated that question, is they determined that the impact of the NEC sea line is that it would reduce electric rates here in Maine. And it would do that because the cost of the transmission line is being paid for by customers in Massachusetts. And so Maine customers don't bear that cost. But the supply of the Canadian hydro coming into the grid, the very large supply, as Ben said, the equivalent of two small nuclear plants, that extra supply coming into Maine and Lewiston will depress wholesale prices. And by depressing wholesale prices, it will depress electric rates. And so there will actually be a rate reduction in Maine because of this project.
And these are the findings of the impartial Maine Public Utilities Commission. This is not our opinion. This has been adjudicated after an 18-month process where all sides of the question were fully engaged.
Right.
Yeah. Thank you, Bruce. We did get a question online. What is Mainers for Clean Energy Jobs and what is your mission? Mainers for Clean Energy Jobs is an informal coalition of business organizations, professional associations, labor unions, and environmental leaders who formed about a year and a half ago to advocate in support of the New England Clean Energy Connect, what's also known as the Clean Energy Corridor. And so we're advocates is what we are. And we speak independently from Central Maine Power and Hydro-Québec. We are our own voice. Thank you for that question. Next question is from Sal in Norway. And a reminder, star 3 on your touchpad if you want to get in the question queue. Sal, are you there? Sal in Norway.
Hello?
Yes,
oh, sorry, I hit mute by mistake.
No
I think
problem.
My question's been talked around. I'm still not 100% clear of the answer. What percentage of the power flowing through will actually be capable of being used in Maine? I heard the swimming pool analogy. Did everyone get the same size straw? Does Maine have a straw? We've heard different bits of information. And the simplest answer would be most appreciated. I also have a follow-up question to what someone else asked. Can I throw that in now or after you answer my first one?
Go ahead.
One person asked about how much equivalent solar power would be needed, and there was an answer something like 90 square miles compared to the water capacity, I believe it was, in Quebec. Is that available power in Quebec right now, or if all that water were utilized, it would produce the equivalent of 90 square miles of power? So is that available power, or does infrastructure have to be, does generating capacity have to be built to produce that?
Got it. Okay. Thank you for that question, those questions, Sal. So the first one, how big is Maine's straw?
I don't.
And the simplest analogy you can think of, or the simplest explanation.
Yeah, I mean,
it does get confusing for folks.
There probably is some useful data on to answer that question out of the proceedings and the analyses that have been submitted to the Maine Public Utilities Commission, but I'm not familiar with that off the top of my head.
Yeah.
But, at the end of the day, Massachusetts is paying for it. So, that's probably an indication. But I'm not that familiar with the analyses that have been done to directly answer the question.
You look like you've got something.
Trying to think about. I understand the question, and it's really hard unless you've been working in, the
electric power sector. I mean, it took me a few years to really understand how does this work. And so that project in Canada is delivering power into New England through Maine. And so would you need to, there's so many kilowatt hours that you would need to deliver to Lewiston, and if you were to deliver all that power all the way down to Connecticut, you're going to lose some of that power through line losses and heat. And so you'd have to maybe deliver a little bit more to get all the way down there. But the idea is that once it's in the New England grid, kind of anybody can use it effectively. And so contractually, Massachusetts has said, we want to pay you for X amount of energy. And so they're going to be pulling that amount of energy out of the larger New England grid, and that grid is going to be supplied by the amount of by the equivalent amount of energy coming in from Canada. And so it's not like the electrons that are coming down stay anywhere. They're constantly going through these power lines and being used by everyone in that electric service territory. I wish I had a simpler, more answer to that.
I'm sorry, Bruce. You...
Well, I was going to say is that kind of the maybe what is a little bit behind the question is the idea is Maine going to benefit?
Yeah.
From the power coming in, even if Massachusetts is buying the megawatt hours, is Maine going to benefit from it?
Right.
And I think back to one of the earlier points you made earlier, which is that you know, even if Massachusetts is paying for it, Maine electric rates are going down because of the price suppression effect of it being
you
going
have
into the system.
Huge supply of electricity coming in, and so at these various substations or nodes on the grid, the amount of electricity going in can actually drive down wholesale market prices. So, yes, but there was a second part to this question.
Yeah, and I think we're running out of time, and I think I'll answer it just very quickly, the solar equivalent question. And is this new infrastructure that we need to be built in Canada? And actually, no, there is existing capacity in Quebec to supply the entirety of the need, the entirety of the demand for this project. So no new reservoir construction would be necessary.
It's basically water that's being spilled on spillways that don't go through turbines but go effectively around them and flow into the ocean. So unused potential energy.
So we are out of time. Clearly, we could have gone for much longer. Thank you all for joining us, and thank you, Bruce and John, for your time and your expertise. I look forward to doing this again very soon.
Thank you.
Good night, everybody.
Thank you, guys.
Good night.
Cheers.
The Access Live event has ended.
Thanks so much for joining the call this evening. If you have a question that we didn't get to tonight, or if you'd like us to contact you with ways to support the project, please call us at 207-370-4238. Leave a message with your contact information, and we'll get back to you later this week. Thanks, and have a great evening.
If you wish to leave a message, please press 1. Otherwise, you may simply hang up. Goodbye.